My name is Susie Vitalo, and I'll be the moderator today. I'm from New York University in Emergency Medicine and Medical Toxicology, and I'm pleased to be part of the panel today. And the name of our session is 4128, the FDA and Public Health, Improving Scientific Integrity, Safety, and Quality of Medical Products. It's like when they tell you on the airplane, if you're not going to San Diego, get off now. It's like, oh my God. Our first speaker this morning will be Dr. Diana Zuckerman. Her talk is called Public Health Implications When Heart Valves, Hip Replacements, and Other Medical Devices Are Not Tested in Clinical Trials. Dr. Zuckerman is the president of the National Research Center for Women and Families, a nonprofit research and education organization that works to improve policies and programs that affect the health of adults and children. In 2007, she founded the center's Cancer Prevention and Treatment Fund. She's frequently quoted in the national media on health and health policy issues. She worked with members of Congress and their staff to strengthen patient safeguards and federal laws and has testified about medical products and FDA policies several dozen times before Congress, the FDA, and the EPA, as well as state legislatures and the Canadian Parliament. After starting her career as a faculty member at Vassar and Yale and as a researcher at Harvard, Dr. Zuckerman worked as a congressional staffer on health policy issues in the United States House of Representatives and Senate. She then served as a senior policy advisor in the Clinton White House. She has been president of the National Research Center for Women and Families since 1999 and a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics since 2006. In 2010, she was inducted as the first non-physician in the Women in Medicine International Hall of Fame. She serves on the board of directors of the Reagan-Udall Foundation and the Alliance for a Stronger FDA. She is the author of 5 books, several book chapters, and dozens of articles in academic journals and national newspapers. She reports no conflicts of interest to report. Dr. Zuckerman.
As you can see, I shortened the title a little bit. I'm very glad to be here, and as you could perhaps tell from my from that very nice introduction, I have been very involved in FDA policy issues, but I started out as an academic, and so I'm always trying to bridge that gap between the training I had in epidemiology and public health and what that should mean in terms of how we decide what medical products are safe and effective, and what the FDA actually does, and it's quite a difference. So I'm going to go through the process briefly and then focus specifically on hips and heart valves and other kinds of medical devices that you might not imagine how those things are approved. I certainly, coming from academia, my original assumption was that the FDA makes sure that everything is safe and effective, and it wouldn't be sold in the United States if it wasn't. So I want to talk a little bit about what that means. For drug approval, it's a little different than devices, but I'll start with drugs. For drug approval, it does have to be proven safe in clinical trials, but that's safe in the short term. And as you all know, many drugs now are used for decades. Hormone replacement therapy would be a really good example of a product that was tested in the short term where it was safe, but over the long term it was found to have very serious side effects that weren't expected. Again, it has to be effective, but it has to be effective compared to placebo, not compared to other products on the market. So just because it's been approved doesn't mean it's better than something else. And a part of that approval process is that the manufacturing facility can be inspected. That doesn't mean that it always is inspected or inspected well, but it can be inspected. For medical devices, the system's a little different, and so I've divided it up into the 3 categories that the FDA divides medical devices, and I'll give you examples of each. But the lowest risk medical devices are not tested at all. The company, all they have to do is tell the FDA that they're selling them. Band-Aids would be an example of that. A medium risk device has to prove that it's substantially equivalent to something else that's on the market, and it's a long story and I won't go into the details, but it was originally supposed to be substantially equivalent to a device that was on the market before 1976, which is when the FDA first started regulating medical devices. that doesn't make a lot of sense. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And then the highest risk devices do require clinical trials, inspections, or can require an inspection, and may also require post-market studies. So once it's on the market, they may require other kinds of studies. Now I'm going to give examples to help you with that. Okay, here's three low-risk devices: tongue depressors, Band-Aids, and crutches. The assumption is that companies know how to make these, they can make them, they don't have to prove that they're safe. Obviously, any of those products could potentially harm people if they weren't made well. But the assumption is that the company's going to make Band-Aids that are sterile and aren't going to cause infections rather than prevent them, that crutches aren't going to break when you use them, and that tongue depressors aren't going to give you splinters in your tongue. So that's the assumption with low-risk devices. No testing required at all. The moderate risk devices really gets into a different kind of issue, because I think different people have a different sense of what is a moderate risk device. The one in the middle is a hip replacement. I happen to have one of those. And that doesn't seem very moderate risk to me. If that's in your body and it breaks, as you may know from the news reports lately, that could wreak havoc. So it's called moderate risk, but it actually can lead to additional surgery, and really very serious and even fatal consequences from that surgery. A contact lens solution is a medical device. You might not think of it as such. Contact lenses are a medical device, and contact lens solution are medical devices. And those are moderate risk devices. Again, most people assume that companies know how to make them. They're not going to make mistakes. But the testing does not require clinical trials. That's a glucose meter for testing blood sugar for diabetics. And then the one on the left, the inferior vena cava filter, I think is a big surprise to people. This is a device that's implanted near the heart. It's to filter out blood clots. And it's supposed to be used temporarily. And because it's supposed to be temporary, meaning implanted for up to 6 months, it's considered a moderate risk device. But in fact, quite a few of them have broken inside the human body, and they have killed some people. So moderate risk doesn't always mean moderate risk. Oops. Uh-oh. All right, well, so let me just go into that. All right, so 98% of the devices that the FDA reviews and either approves or what's called clears are done through this process for moderate risk devices called the 510K process. The Institute of Medicine recently came out with a report pointing out that this does not require they be proven safe or effective. What they have to prove is that they're substantially equivalent to other devices that are legally on the market. They do not have clinical trials. They do not have inspections. They can't even ask for inspections. The FDA cannot even ask for inspections prior to letting them go on the market. And they are not allowed to require post-market studies. So no studies before they're on the market, no clinical trials before they're on the market, and you can't require them afterwards unless something happens later, but you can't do it as a condition of approval. Then the higher risk devices, and here's some examples of that. I didn't know exactly what that thing was on the bottom left. That's actually an artificial heart. The one in the middle is an illustration of a pacemaker, and the one on the right is an infusion pump. So these are things that are considered potentially life-saving or life-threatening, and so they're considered high-risk devices, and they are supposed to be held to a standard similar to those for prescription drugs. It's called the pre-market approval system, or PMA. It's a little different from drugs. Drugs have to be safe and effective. These devices have to be reasonably safe and reasonably effective. What does that mean? Actually, nobody knows. It's a nice subjective term. But for example, it's based on one clinical trial. There are almost never double-blind clinical trials. They usually have smaller samples than are used for prescription drug trials. So they are similar, but not quite as high a standard as for prescription drugs. FDA approval of drugs and devices does not mean that nobody will die from this product. It does not mean that few people will be harmed by this product. It does not mean the product is safe for long-term use. And it does not mean that the product is more effective than other products on the market, or cheaper, or in any way better than other products that are already on the market. And in fact, a lot of times with drugs, I think you all know that the newest drugs that are on patent are much more expensive than the older drugs, although sometimes they're not nearly as effective. And the standards of safety and effectiveness really do have to do with the risk to benefit ratio. It can harm people as long as most people will benefit from it rather than be harmed. I'm going to give a few examples, a few specific examples from recent time. For those of you who wear contact lenses, Renew contact lens solution is a very popular contact lens solution, and they've been selling them for many years. But a few years ago, they came out with a new and improved version called Renew with Moisture Lock, which was approved as equivalent, not to their own older contact lens solution, but to another company's contact lens solution. No clinical trials were required. As I said, this is a moderate risk device. No inspection of manufacturing plant occurred before it was sold. And they discovered that after people started using this new product, I should mention I got several free samples from my eye doctor when my children and I went for our contact lenses, some people started getting eye infections and some people started going blind. So when that happened and they figured out that it was associated with this particular contact lens solution, the FDA went and inspected the plant where it was made, and they found more than a dozen violations. They found contamination. For example, little specks of white paint and other things were falling down from the ceiling into the vats of contact lens solution before it was before they were sealed. They also found that the contact lenses solution, after it was being made, were being stored in vans outside that were getting to like 130 degrees. And when the company applied for approval, they said that this would be stored at room temperature. And I don't think anybody thinks 130 degrees qualifies for that. But what was interesting is that after all these inspections, the FDA found out that actually the problem was how the contact lens solution was made. It was very similar to other contact lens solution, but it was missing one ingredient, which happened to kill certain bacteria. And without that ingredient, the bacteria weren't getting killed. And probably the combination of the hot temperatures and the lack of this ingredient caused the problems. It didn't cause everybody to get eye infections. But what often happens with contact lens solution is, and contact lenses for that matter, is if you follow directions exactly, you'll be fine. But if you do things like wash your hands at the wrong time or use water instead of contact lens solution some of the time, that's going to cause or take a shower with your contact lenses. I didn't know you were not supposed to do that, but I found out when I looked into this. So that's an example where substantial equivalence, it's supposed to be that you have a similar purpose, in this case, contact lens solution. Yes, one contact lens solution has the same purpose as another. And it's supposed to be made out of similar material or a similar mechanism of action. In this case, yes, it was similar, but not similar enough, not identical, similar and missing something crucial. And so it brings up the issue, can contact lens solution be a high-risk medical device? Well, I guess it can be if it makes you blind. So I think everybody here knows the purpose of clinical trials, but in terms of medical devices, if you have clinical trials, it will provide evidence of risks that you might not know otherwise, and especially for products made of different materials or used differently, in this case, contact lens solution. Had there been clinical trials, they would have seen potentially a risk in eye infections. And clinical trials, of course, also provide evidence of effectiveness, not just of safety. And so then one of the questions that arises, is it ethical to use an implant that hasn't been scientifically tested on either humans or animals? Is it ethical to have these substantial equivalence tests, which usually are bioengineering tests? you look at, you know, a list of the ingredients, but you don't actually test it in a human being or even in an animal. The Government Accountability Office came out with a report talking about how these moderate risk devices, again, are called 510K because of the law, it's a provision of the law, that between 2003 and 2007, this process, this review process with no clinical trials, was used for over 13,000 of the low risk and moderate risk devices, and 90% of them were cleared. So it was not a very high standard. In addition, during those years, the FDA had reviewed 342 Class 3 devices. The Class 3 devices are the high-risk devices that are not supposed to go through this system, but they did, and they cleared two-thirds of those. And some of those devices were for life-sustaining devices and implanted devices. Our center did a study, and we looked at high-risk recalls. These are the recalls that the FDA said these devices had to be recalled because they could kill you or seriously and permanently harm you. And for the last 5 years, we looked at the highest-risk recalls. There were 113 high-risk recalls, and they represented 113 million devices. Just happened to be the same number. So it's an average of a million devices for each recall. And in the graph, you can see that the vast majority of these high-risk recalls were for devices that went through what's called the 510K process. No clinical trials, no inspections. The PMA, which is this higher standard, was under 20% of the high-risk recalls. So somehow, high-risk devices aren't causing the high-risk recalls. It's these so-called moderate-risk devices that the FDA thinks are moderate risk and don't require clinical trials, and yet they're the ones that are being recalled because they could kill people. So our feeling was, well, if a device can kill you if it fails, doesn't that make it a high risk device to begin with, and shouldn't it have gone through clinical trials to begin with and inspections? And then just quickly, this is to show you what kind of devices they were. You can see most of these high-risk recalls were of cardiovascular devices. In some cases, devices that absolutely were intended to save a person's life who had a heart attack, and some of these were on batteries that did not work. And so when the batteries failed and the device failed, the person died. We also looked at deaths that have been reported to the FDA. These are not based on clinical trials. These are based on what's reported to the FDA, absolutely just the tip of the iceberg. But just in 2009, there were over 4,500 deaths associated with medical devices, and that was a 60% increase compared to 2006. Almost half of those deaths were from devices that had not gone through clinical trials, that were either these 510K devices or the ones that were exempt from any review, the ones that I told you, the companies don't even have to do any kind of testing at all. And two-thirds of those deaths were related to cardiovascular devices, such as a heart valve repair device. 12% were general hospital devices. That means devices that could be used for anybody in a hospital. So how could we improve the safety of medical devices? This is where, you know, I'm so used to talking about this, but I know when I talk to people who do not deal with FDA issues all the time, people are just shocked. How could this be? Well, I think most of us know the importance of clinical trials. If we had clinical trials required for implanted medical devices, for example, for all implanted medical devices, whether they're artificial hearts or hips, you could find out if there was a design flaw in the product. You could find out if there was a manufacturing flaw, and any flaws could be caught sooner, either with clinical trials, inspections, or what are called post-market studies. The other thing that we really, truly need are long-term post-market studies. And whether you're talking about drugs or devices, you don't want to know whether that hip's going to last for a year. You want to know if it's going to last for 5 or 10 or, you know, preferably 15 years. When I went and got my hip a year ago, I looked for studies to find out what are the hip replacements that last the longest. I wanted to have this surgery, you know, once or twice in my life. I didn't want to have it, you know, every few years. There's no data because no clinical trials are required. in order to get approval, and so therefore there's no data to show which ones last longer, which ones break or crack. excuse me, since I got my device, quite a few metal-on-metal hip replacements have been in the news for causing what's called debris wear, where little particles of metal get into the bloodstream and can cause terrible reactions. Also, just in case you're not depressed enough, the FDA does not have the authority to rescind approval of unsafe devices that have been cleared through the 510K process. So they can't require clinical trials, they can't require post-market studies, and once they're cleared, they cannot require that these products be taken off the market. They can urge them to recall them, and that's what usually happens because the company doesn't want to get sued. But if it's a recall, that means a company can start making them again in the future without getting new approval. And to just end up, I want to talk about what does substantially equivalent mean and how should we be thinking about it. And I thought about how the FDA talks about substantial equivalence, and I thought, well, based on their standard, a steak is like milk. How is a steak like milk? Well, they both come from cows. The intent of both of them is to provide, you know, sustenance, nutritional value. They both have nutritional value. They both taste good. You know, these are really substantially equivalent according to FDA kind of standards. Here's another comparison, a real one, where the one on the left are what are called were called Vitek TMJ implants. These were used in the jaw joint, the TMJ joint, for relatively minor TMJ problems. And they were approved by the FDA as substantially equivalent to a sheet of silicone. It's called silicone sheeting. It looks like, you know, plastic, but it's silicone. And it could be cut into shape and used in various surgeries. And that had been on the market since prior to 1976, I believe. And so the Vitek implants were substantially equivalent. It ended up that the friction from the jaw joint is actually the most used joint in the body because you use it when you breathe and when you talk and when you eat. You use it when you kiss. You use it when you drink. I mean, you're using it all the time. And the friction caused little pieces of, it was actually made with Teflon. That was a brilliant idea on somebody's part. And so these little tiny specks of metal were coming out, going into the bloodstream, and causing severe reactions. So that some of the people with these could no longer eat. They could only drink liquids, could not eat food anymore. And some of them would have a reaction where the bone would not just deteriorate at the joint, what was left of their bone, but would also get into the skull, and they were getting holes in their skull where their brains were no longer protected. That's an example of one of the mistakes FDA made a few years ago. These are lovely photos. You know, obviously, contact lens solution that works, keeps your eyes healthy. Those are real photos of real eye infections caused by recalled contact lens solution. The top one was a bacterial infection. The bottom one's actually from a parasite that was growing in the eye as a result of contact lens solution. Now here's a different example. These are bladder slings. There are several different products, and they've been in the news too. Surgical mesh that is used for particularly for female incontinence, which is a very, very common problem. Now, those both look the same. They're similar products, but the one on the left was made with Gore-Tex, which some of you may have a jacket made out of Gore-Tex. It's an interesting fabric, which, by the way, is related to Teflon, you'll be happy to know. On the right is Protogen, which was a company's name, which was a bladder sling made out of Hermashield, which was a new synthetic fabric coated with collagen. Seemed like a nice fabric. It was approved as cleared as substantially equivalent to Gore-Tex, but in fact, they found out that this new fabric caused terrible infections, and women who started out with minor stress incontinence were ending up with horrible infections, atrophy of the vagina, and some other problems where they could, in some cases, no longer have sex or even, you know, sit down without pain. So, Finally, I compare my apples and oranges, two fruits, both round, both good for you, very substantially equivalent. Gee, hardly a difference. But we do have an expression about apples and oranges, and I think it's apropos here. When products are different, you can't assume that if one is good for you, the other one is necessarily going to be good for you, or either safe or effective. So in conclusion, more than 90% of medical devices that do go through an FDA process have no clinical trials. Most of them are those moderate risk 510K devices. Sometimes the FDA does ask for clinical trials for those, but for the most part, they don't, and they're not supposed to. So only under certain circumstances do they do that. For the PMA, which is the higher risk devices, clinical trials are short term and they're less stringent than they are for medications. And I like to point out, you know, that even the clinical trials for, a artificial heart generally are less stringent than ones for prescription tummy medications. The standards are just lower, smaller trials, not necessarily double blind and so on. Of course, you can't do a double-blind trial with an artificial heart. I mean, you do have to be, think about how can you do these trials, but you could do clinical trials that are larger and more long-term. Products that are cleared through this 510K process, hips and knees and contact lens solution and contact lenses and many cardiac devices as well, have not been proven safe or effective. They've been proven substantially equivalent to something else that is assumed to be safe and effective, but may not have ever also been proven safe and effective. And the standards for insurance coverage and for Medicare, I just wanted to point out, are actually higher than the FDA standards. There are medical devices that the FDA has allowed to be sold that Medicare will not pay for and that insurance companies will not pay for because they want to see, oddly enough, clinical trials proving that they're safe and effective. So sometimes nonprofit organizations have been asked to complain that Medicare or insurance companies aren't covering something, and sometimes there's good reason for that. But for medical devices, often the reason is they're not proven safe and effective, and that's why they're not covered. So that's it. I hope you are careful with your medical devices in the future. One of the things that I like to say is that, you know, there's not a lot we can do about this personally, but on a systemic level, our center and working with my colleagues here, we are trying very hard to get the FDA to use a higher standard for medical devices, and the medical device companies are fighting very vigorously against it, saying the system is great just the way it is and we don't need to make it any different and clinical trials really are not necessary. And one of the things I've had to say is that when you think about pharma, who I'm not a big fan, but when you think about pharma, they do clinical trials without thinking about it, and they're willing to pay substantial user fees to the FDA to get their products reviewed more quickly, and the device companies, you know, so it ends up, pharma ends up looking like, you know, public health advocates compared to the medical device companies. I never thought I'd say that, but unfortunately true. Thank you. Thank you very much for the excellent presentation.